Okay, I'm sorry, I know it's a bit warm here, but I don't know if we can manage the air conditioning, so we'll try to survive. Okay, so you are very welcome to proceed.
Okay, thank you for the introduction, and also thank you for inviting me over to this really stimulating workshop, and that it is really about the current challenges as something I found out only this morning, that not only our collaboration, but also ISPAN and this group has also published last week a paper on the preprint server on Waking Dead. So I will do the best as I can to comment on this, but it's really taken as a real invitation to take part into the discussion and really participate in this talk and comment whenever I can. Okay. What would be the topic of this talk? Network epidemic models. Are you really concerned just with connections among people? You have here just as a brief sketch of an SIR epidemic taking place on a network. So you have these green guys being susceptible for an infection, those red ones already having been infected, and the gray ones shaded out have quite immunity of infection. And if you zoom in, you see that you typically have quite a bit of heterogeneity in the number of contacts that you find in these kind of networks. And you may ask, I mean, would you assign the same weight to all of these? What you do in classical network epidemic models is usually that you assume that each contact is assigned the same way. So you assume that this guy on the left hand side just two contacts maintains these contacts at the same intensity as the other guy does with 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 contacts. So the other guy would probably have a hard time to do this at the same intensity at the same time. So the question is, does it maybe rather look like this, so that the guy which is a bit more selective in how he or she makes his or her contacts is maybe a high weight to these contacts. And weights, in terms of epidemiology, can mean a lot of things, depending really on the kind of infectious disease you're looking at. So weight could be, for sexually transmitted diseases, the number of sex acts that you have, or for airborne infections, maybe the closeness of contacts you have with the person. So this is a question that may arise, and to motivate this further, you can look at survey data. There are plenty of survey data, and I really don't want to go to quality or questions of quality of survey data, just to give you one example of a study that's regularly done in the UK, the National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles. There people are asked about the number of partners people had during the last year, also the number of sex acts they had during the last year. So, and what you see is this joint distribution that shows up from the survey data. And then you may ask, I mean, does this really look like a straight linear dependency? Say you have 5 partners, you have 5 sex acts, you have 10 partners, you have 10 sex acts in a short time frame. That's not quite, okay, you wouldn't expect. Maybe you have something like a roughly linear dependency, but this doesn't look neither like a roughly linear dependency in the sex. Maybe it's rather independent. So I don't want to argue here about judging on what you can see in the data. It's just to get an idea of that maybe assuming linear dependency is too easy, and that you would have to generalize this to have a good epidemic model fitting with your survey data. And that's basically what I would like to talk about, that we have been working on to derive an analytic framework to provide some tools in this direction. So what is the basic idea of the epidemic model that we are developing? We are looking at simple SIR model on a network. And as I said, we want not only to quantify the number of contacts a person has, we would also like to quantify the weights the person assigns or can assign to the contact that he or she has. And what we basically do is the same thing as we have seen in the NASAL data. We just count. And we say we subdivide the number of persons being susceptible, those being infected, and those being recovered into subgroups according to the number of contacts they have, K, in this matrix from the top to bottom, and the number of interaction events they have in total per individual. So that's on the horizontal line in these matrices. So that can be two contacts, zero interaction events, two contacts, one interaction event, two interaction events, and so on. So you do just simple bookkeeping to evaluate this joint probability distribution. How do you do this? I mean, maybe just to give you just a brief idea with this like small sketchy network. So you have your guys with your contacts and your weights symbolized by this little bullets. And then you just count, you write numbers on them, counting their contacts and the number of interaction events. And you can write this down just in matrix to end up with the joint probability distribution. So half of them has like one contact, one interaction event, but there are also some people with, so one person with four contacts and four interaction events, so something highly active, which is a bad example, which would support linearity, as I noticed, no, but you see that you have more variations in this matrix.
Sorry, I probably haven't paid attention at the right moment, but can you explain what the difference is between your contact and an interaction event?
The contact is the number of links that you see here. This person has four contacts.
What does the degree?
So, the degree.
Okay,
the degree
now it's clear. Sorry.
And the interaction event of five. So this is basically the weights that the person is, or the attention the person can pay to its context, be it meeting people or having sex, depending on what you're interested in.
So those are existence of links, and the bullets, those dots, are the level of contact.
Yes.
They are in contact with different levels of contact.
Yeah. So these are the network weights.
Right.
In other terms.
Well.
And not necessarily a person that has more connections, necessarily each connection is less intense. So do you have a constraint on the total intensity?
No. You can just arbitrarily choose. You have just a joint probability distribution that you can define as you like.
I'm not sure. Basically, your underlying network is constant, right? And it's still a 0-1 matrix. However, your process, your betas or your deltas, they are independent. So instead of having one beta, you have a beta I depending on the link. That's basically what you're doing, right?
Yep. So the infection is in a way transmitted at twice the rate along this link because you the intensity is.
Yeah, because a weighted network would mean that you have different large tunnels and that topologically you have a different network. That's what we call weighted. Yeah. Then, okay, it's terminology.
Right.
It's
a weight related to the disease dynamics. There are some other weights you can put that are unrelated to the disease dynamic, just other.
You can, for instance, have different ways. You have a highway or another way in which you connect to people in different means.
Mm-hmm.
And then I will talk about a weighted network.
Okay.
However, the strength on which you infect or meet or interact is your dynamic process. It has nothing to do with your topology.
In the way that the way is always.
Yeah, it makes the description of your differential equations much, much more simple if you do it like that.
We can discuss this, I've just defined weight like it was like the strength of a direction relevant for this disease transmission. Yeah.
for the whole network, but you could also restrict yourself to the subgroup of the network. So you could also ask how these distributions look among people being susceptible, or focus on people being infected, or those already having recovered from the disease. And you notice during the epidemic process that you would probably end up with different distributions because people, a lot of contacts and a lot of interaction, and are more likely to get infected. And so you get biases in the distributions in the epidemic process. Okay, so this is basically how you define your contact, your weighted contact network. Contacts, the degrees of nodes, waves are the number of interaction events, potential transmission events relevant for the disease that you're looking at. And those are assigned per individual. And the individual can distribute them randomly among his or her contacts.
How do you guarantee consistency?
Consistency says
because the interaction event is symmetric.
Yeah. I will come to this later. This is indeed a problem. This will come up, show up again when I talk about like how we generate these networks from the distributions and to make this consistent. And there are some cases where the problems arise. So how do we plug it into the equations? In principle, we could use just the joint probability distribution. But what we do is that we could just choose a different language and go to the probability generating functions, which is just an identical. It's equivalent. It's a different language, which is more handy to use in the equations we're going to derive. So whereas you have like the intuitive picture for the joint probability distribution, you have for the probability generating function, this polynomial in the joint probability distribution from which you can derive quite handily quantities like the average number of contacts, the average degree in the network, or the average number of interaction events, so that the total weight person has. Okay. So how do we derive the equations from this network definition? What we first do is we very naively write down a set of equations for the temporal dynamics and number of susceptible and infected and recovered individuals in each KL class. So each class corresponding to individuals with degree K and like attention span L, so to speak, so it's the total weight to assign to among the K contacts. And people leave the susceptible class at the rate proportional to the transmission rate of the disease, that's beta, proportional to the total weight they assign, so the attention they spend with their contacts, that's L. And a quantity PSI, which is the probability that contact or contact maintained by this individual, a susceptible individual, is made with an infected individual. And then this goes just further. I mean, people leaving the susceptible class will end up in the infected class from which they recover at a certain rate gamma and show up in the recovered class. From there, it's rather straightforward. And then, I mean, that's of course good, but what you're really interested in is the total number of susceptible and infected individuals, and what you just do is summing up over K and L to get the total quantities, and then you see that there are, that you find some averages in the number of weight, and there you see that it comes quite handy in to have the correspondence with the probability generating function from which you can easily derive these averages as the partial derivatives at x and y root 1. But still, the system is obviously not closed, and you have to derive equations for the PSI.
And how is this done? I'm not going into all the details of the calculations here, but would refer you to the preprint, but the basic idea is that you really just keep track of the way links among susceptible individuals, susceptible and affected individuals are maintained and changed as a result of the epidemic process. So you have an MS as the number of links made by susceptible people. MSS and MSI are the number of susceptible of links among susceptible and infected individuals. And here, to derive their primary function, you have to take into account how the infection process works, so that the people are infected proportional to the number of interaction events and how this is related to the degree they have, the number of contacts, which is linked to the joint probability distribution that you plug in the first place. So this is a bit of calculating that I could go in maybe later in the discussion, but it's rather technical and not maybe it doesn't give so much insight here. And from this, if you have all counted all the links, you can derive the time resolution of PSS and PSI. So the probabilities for a contact made a susceptible node to point to a susceptible node, so no infection there, or to point to an infected node. And that's what you get when deriving all, when going through all these calculations. And then you see you're still there with all your averages and the number of k times L. So here is where the probability distribution to have contacts and interaction among susceptible people comes in, and it's time evolution, and where you need to derive also the equation for probability generating functions. And here really helps again with this analogy that you have between the joint probability distribution and the probability generating functions. And then this is rather straightforward to calculate. You see on the right hand side this GS of X and Y is given by this polynomial and the fraction of the number of susceptible in the KL class divided by the total number of susceptibles. If you plug just linear equations we had from the start, evaluate everything and end up with a partial differential equation for your probability generating function. And taking this together, your system of equations is closed. We'll summarize this just briefly. So what have we done? We have kept track of the number of susceptible and affected and recovered, so basically keeping track of epidemic prevalence. We haven't kept track of the way links are kept or retained during the epidemic process among susceptible and affected individuals, and we have kept track of the degree distribution among those being susceptible. We could, in principle, do easily the same thing for the degree distribution of infected people or recovered people, but it's not needed because the system of equations here.
So when you're calculating the probability that only goes from susceptible to infected individual, do you not have to more exactly calculate the probability that the link has a certain weight L? So for example, PSL1, IL2.
Up here in this this equation here.
Well, there and also your equations for PSI dot.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, you are right. To make it even more exact, you assume that implicitly when you derive the formulas, you pick an individual proportional to the total weight, has so the total attention it spreads along its contact. In principle, you're right. If you're not equidistribute your attention so that you maybe focus most attention to one contact, you should also select with respect to the weight attached to this specific contact. But we haven't done this. Honestly, I haven't found a good analytical way to do it. It could be done in an extension, but it works pretty well here because you can spread rather homogeneously among your contacts.
Okay, so this is really just a very good approximation.
So you implicitly make also the assumption of independence between infections of nodes, right? Because otherwise you have to take into account all possible configurations in which all the nodes in the network can be infected or not. And that configuration will of course be dependent on all the rest. Yeah? And if you get rid of... No?
I'm not sure whether I understood your question correctly.
Well, your first set of equations seem to implicitly make independence of infection between nodes, right? Because otherwise you should write the joint probability distribution that node 1 is infected, node 2 is infected, node 3 is infected, and so on. That's the real exact description. And if you get rid of that one, then you come up with these equations. So this is again mean field like we call it. Right?
It's mean field like so where this trace about on Eric, it's gonna get it's going to get the number of infections right in the deterministic limit, but you aren't saying who is infected.
Yeah.
You're just saying that this fraction of people with degree 1 are infected at given 1.
Okay.
Represents the situation in static network. It's not like this fully makes heterogeneous type of model. So we are looking at a static network here. Okay. So then we are coming to the next tricky issue, the network generation issue. This is of course so good, you can write down a lot of equations, but if this doesn't mean anything for real world networks, then it's probably much help. So how did we generate networks here? So first thing is easy, we just choose our joint probability distribution. We generate nodes that have like k half contacts or stops, and we assign L weights according to PKL. So that's why we just have these guys with two numbers on that. And then, as I mentioned, there would be different ways to distribute the weights among persons' contacts. We restricted ourselves at the moment for a rather homogeneous distribution, so we just distributed them multinomially here. And then we do just random matching of the stats, respecting the weights. So, this also looks...
Well, that's right, the configuration on the...
Yes. So we don't have any higher order correlations about how... that's quite true. Not yet correlations, I will come to that later. But we do just random matching here, like... Okay. And what do we see then? In principle, an infinite choice of joint probability distributions that we could choose from. So we wanted to keep it really simple from the beginning, and we thought about maybe it's interesting to see how combinations between homogeneous and heterogeneous behavior and the number of contacts, or degrees of nodes, and the number of interaction events or attention a person has to spend affects the outcome of the epidemic event. So we have looked at this matrix of distribution, just independent combinations of Poisson distribution and power law distribution, so homogeneous and heterogeneous distribution, either for the number of contacts, for the degree, or the number of interaction events. And then we had a look at the weight, the weights that we need to match. So we have this algorithm, as you remember, you have your individuals, and they have their contacts, and they get their, like, the budget of weight that they have then to distribute among their K contacts. And then here it's just like, just on the x-axis, the stops in the linear row, and the weights that they go to sign. And this looks all pretty foggy and doesn't probably tell you much. But then you see that you get some matching problems in some situations. Yeah? And that goes in the direction that you already pointed at earlier. I mean, if you're in a situation where you have a homogeneous number of contacts, a homogeneous number of weights, you will end up roughly with the same weight on all your contacts. So that's easy to do some matching there. A similar situation if both arises if both distributions are heterogeneous. So then you have nodes that have many contacts and high weights, many contacts, low weights, few contacts, high weights, few contacts, little weights. But you have all kinds of weights in your network that you're able to match. So you won't get segregation. Things become a bit more tricky, really, how to define your network. If you look at the case when you have a degree distribution, the number of contacts is heterogeneous, and you have rather homogeneous, like a constant number of weights to assign, then you end up in a situation that guys with just one contact have all the attention to one person, whereas people who have many, many contacts have only the same way to distribute among their contacts. And then you will have some kind of network segregation, which is worse really for those people being having single contacts, because already persons having two contacts will have on average half the weight on their contacts, and they will hardly match. So they're almost forced to build monogamous couples.
Do I always consider that K and M are independent variables?
Yes, for this just the case that you could choose other variables. But
I think we are waiting, then it's negative. The straight function interactions are always super linear in the degree. It looks like the degree to some power is about 1 meter.
Yeah, I mean, this is debatable. I think the Nassau data I mean, that would make the network generation easier. This is just to test the model here. You could plug in your realistic degree distribution, but probably have less trouble. I just point you to the trouble first, so maybe it's not a good way to sell the whole thing. But I will come to this later. I hope to point you to that as well. And then there is another situation where you also run into trouble how to define your network. Namely, when you have a rather homogeneous number of contacts, and then you assign a heterogeneous number of weights. So there will be some people having very low weights and some very high weights, which will lead to some kind of weights. So just to summarize this, to get an overview, there are two phenomena that you have. Combine heterogeneous and homogeneous distributions here. On the one hand, you have a strong contact associativity that leads to network segregation. On the other hand, you can create a strong weight associativity that is intrinsically not considered in the analytical approach per se, because it's just looking at it has a node sample view as it is. We can consider this as well in the next step, but just keep in mind that there are some issues that might have been hidden in the model so far. Okay, so how did we work with this in our network generation algorithm? To be honest with you, we did, as I said, so we chose the joint probability distribution. distribution, we generated the node with the stubs, we distributed the weights, and then we did the stub matching, respecting the weights, which is almost true because we allowed for some tolerance to avoid extreme network segregation. Yeah. And so we allowed to have one interaction event difference for stubs to match. So we say, okay, in real life, probably you're willing to negotiate, but I mean, if your friend is not doesn't want to meet you today, you probably won't quit to leave it at that. Or not more than 10% difference among interaction events. This is because when you remember that there was quite a range of weights, so just one action event is probably not isn't sufficient to be measured. And then we end up with an empirical joint distribution here that we denote p-bar kl. And then we compare the results that we get for all different scenarios. I'll try to walk you through these slides step by step. You see like the four cases again, the combinations of homogeneous and heterogeneous distributions in degree and interaction events. And the gray shaded thing in the back is what you got from simulation results. Then the red lines is what we got when we just naively plugged PKL without thinking about what problems might arise in doing the matchmaking. Then there is this red dashed line. You can't really see it because it's pretty close. You see that there isn't much difference that you see in the joint probability distribution of the resulting epidemic prevalence predicted by the model by doing this little tolerance in matchmaking, but it saved us from this extreme and unrealistic network segregation. And then there are the orange curves, which are especially prominent in this case. You may want to know what this is about, and this is actually a correction that we have done to the PDD approach to take care of this contact assortativity that is especially pronounced in this case. So what we basically have done here is we have swept out all the singletons, not singletons, but for those persons just having one contact, because they have hardly any other chance than to make contact among each other, and so they are not connected to the giant component and don't participate in the epidemic spreading. And then you see that you get results that really match well. You see in the simulations. Okay, and then there's still one line that I didn't explain, and that is the black dotted line, and this is a prediction that we did for the early epidemic expansion. And you probably see this better on a logarithmic scale. That this fits rather well. Here's the formula given that we have derived from our set of PDEs. The only case where we underestimate the early epidemic spread is this year. That's the case where we had the case of weight assortativity. So what you have here is that you have a tendency in the network for nodes to connect with nodes with a similar weight. So they then early spreads among nodes with a high weight and dies out earlier. So the total epidemic curve is rather well represented, but the early epidemic expansion is underestimated. Well. Okay. This is just to briefly summarize the formula. I think it's probably a bit to go through all this in detail. We have on the one hand the classical results for early epidemic expansion. The exponent r, small r, zero, the classical network where you have a linear dependency between the number of contacts and weight.
on the content and those relationships that we've derived here for our model. And what you see is, I think, or what I would like to point to is what explains a bit also what we've seen in the simulations and in the approaches, that there's always like the second order of moments of the joint probability distribution that determines the epidemic spread. So you have here, I mean, of course, it's k to the square because the weights are aligned with the degree. But here you have always k times out. So if you have independent distributions that are not in line, that will slow your epidemic. And here, this is just a past comment towards, I think, the work of Isman's group. I'm not sure whether I got it right, but you could have also assign a constant amount of weight for each individual, which is, I think, in your case, termed the fixed deterministic weight distribution, and then up with R naught of this structure. There are slightly different assumptions here in this model than in the paper is funding this group. So while we here look really at joint distributions in the number of weights and its degrees, there's no freedom in assigning the weight in the other model. Okay, and how did we see maybe that this overlap, the correlations in the number of weights and degrees affect the epidemic spreading? Maybe it's good to look at the curves from another perspective once more. Maybe a little bit purplish, but we can start with a light purple to see the cases for the homogeneous network and the heterogeneous network epidemic prevalence. And that's what you see in classical networks. You have a faster, earlier epidemic expansion in the heterogeneous networks as compared to the homogeneous networks. So these are the pink curves shifted a bit to the left. And then you combine this with the homogeneous weight distribution and independent distribution in both cases to see that you have a shift in peak prevalence, and also for the latter case, quite a increase over prevalence over time, so the number of total number of infected, which is basically the area under the curve. And similarly, if you have a power law distribution for the weights, you have similar observations. So the epidemic is slowed and has a lower reach. And this is basically what you saw before in the formulas of R1. If you have independent network weighting, it slows the epidemic, so the prevalence, and reduces the overall number of infections. We have compared this also with predictions from other approaches. I wouldn't go really in all the details about how these rates of early exponential expansions have been derived, but I just would like to point you to this overview, because what you've shown here is on the x-axis the predicted doubling time, so we've now translated from the rate of expansion into the doubling time, so that's equivalent over the simulated doubling time, the set of networks we generated, and see how these match. And you see that a lot of our method is those ones with the red dots, which match pretty well with the x-y-axis representing the identity, whereas quite a few of the other methods labeled to the left, which means that they predict a too short doubling time, which has to do, it's maybe not too surprising, but because most of these approaches implicitly assume a fully mixed network approach, so it's a dynamic network which keeps the epidemic. So there's another issue. You see this outlier here also in our approach, and that's what I pointed you to earlier in this network, that you have in the case of a homogeneous contact distribution and
and heterogeneous weight distribution, you have this deviation due to the weight of subjectivity that is inherently not considered in the PDE approach so far. Okay, so now I'm coming back to hopefully a bit more realistic data and then leave the area for the moment, this rather artificial networks, and then try to apply this this formalism to the NATSAR data. Here you have again the joint on the left hand side, the joint probability distribution for a certain number of partners and a certain number of sex acts during the time interval. At the boundaries of the matrix, you see the marginal distribution for each of them. And then we plug just into our formalism. In the first run, we just ask what happens if we do it classically. We just look at the number of contacts, yeah? And then we get different predictions. We do an SI model and get the red curve for just looking at the number of contacts. So we get considerable epidemic prevalence. This is also reflected again in the dashed line. We have here the only exponential growth is positive. Then we plug in the whole joint distribution. We are well aware that partners are seen during 1 year are not really concurrent, and that there are a lot of approximations, and that this is so far not in formalism for bipartite network. So there are a lot of issues, yeah, that we can have to need addressed, yeah. But we just wanted to choose a look. And then we see that we have much lower epidemic prevalence when plugging in the whole distribution. Yeah? And you see here also even the rate of early epidemic expansion is negative. The only thing that's still positive is this like mean field rate of early epidemic expansion. So the epidemic expansion that you get, if the epidemic spreads from randomly picked nodes, not by nodes picked by the epidemic. So you can imagine that by any means, some people get infected in your population, just flying in from somewhere or whatever, yeah? And they will spread a few infections, but as soon as the epidemic has settled, it is not self-maintained anymore. So this shows, although probably not really a realistic prediction about epidemics in the heterosexual population, that waiting contracts can have quite a drastic impact on the epidemic, on epidemics taking place in this level.
Maybe you're about to come onto this, but if you were to fit your transmission parameter to give you prevalence that matches with the data, mm-hmm. Do the red and the blue curves in fact look the same?
You mean by the rescaling of the transmission parameter?
Yeah. So if you were to use this model, you would fit it to prevalence data, and therefore the equilibrium levels would be the same.
Fitting the transmission parameter would only vary time scale, because you don't have recovery here, it's just an SI model.
Surely you could get a higher level of prevalence by increasing the transmission rate.
I mean the transmission just I now I see what you mean. I was thinking of transmission per interaction and I have the interaction per weight. So then you would increase the weight of this terminology.
Yeah. It's the way it was
there. Yeah, but then increasing the weight would correspond like looking at a longer time scale, you have a higher weight and then you have again this rescaling time scale and shrinking your axis.
Okay, I don't think I followed, but I'll leave it.
But I was thinking myself, I must have to take a way to take this epidemic off, and I just couldn't. But we maybe have another discussion on that later, and maybe I'm mistaken with this as well. Could well be. Yeah. Okay. So maybe in comparison with another study that will also be presented by Mathieu in a poster during this conference, is a study, a simulation study on contact tracing study among homosexual contacts among men having sex with men and them. And I don't go into all the details of their assumptions, but what they were looking at is that they looked at their network, reconstructed the network, and had different ways to assign ways to their contacts. They were looking on one hand at the classical linear model, and then they had some different ways to assign weights, so something to say that everybody has the same, like sex potential or attention, that someone spends to all their partners. And then they have different ways of assigning these sex acts among their partners. And what they found is that whatever deviation or heterogeneity they introduced from the linear case led to an introduction of yoga and expansion. So if you want to know more details, you can just refer to my poster on that. This brings me to my outlook here. As you've seen from the discussions in the talk, there are still quite a few technical issues that have to be resolved to become more realistic, implementations that are inherently in the analytical model, although it can pretty well predict epidemic in many cases. And I think that one of the most serious issues is that the joint probability distribution has an inherently point-centered view. It doesn't see the assortative effects that are or that may be introduced by the weight distribution that can be so strong with them that they really to network segregation into subnetworks. And there are both things. I mean, the question is how realistic is this and how can this really be parametrized? And then, of course, it's just a simple configuration type model. We don't look at higher order characteristics like clustering. We don't deal with dynamic networks. We don't deals with problem backtrack networks, although I think that's probably just a tedious thing to add on that trench principle thing that shouldn't be possible. And maybe just as a remark at the end, so far we're looking at networks of epidemic spread, but in principle, this should apply also to other propagation phenomena networks, whether it's spreading of rumors or cellular signaling pathways or metabolic networks, or maybe also gene regulatory networks. So there should also be some weighting processes that should be considered and where you may have similar effects. With this, I would like to point you to the preprint that we just posted on the preprint server of the week, and where you will find more details on this approach. Soon, proper publication on this. And with, in any case, I'd like to thank my collaborators, Samuel Ellison and Matthieu Lefebvre, with whom I worked in this project. And thank you for your attention. And looking forward to
Okay, thank you. There was already some discussion, but this is still some time.
Thanks for this presentation. Maybe I missed it or I'm too deep, but I was wondering about if you prepare the Poisson power distributions. Do you always assume that the mean of those distributions is the same? So the total number of interactions and the total number of contacts is the same?
We've always been looking at contact distributions with an average number of contacts, the average degree of 4. And the weight distribution had always twice the mean, so 8 interaction events per individual. So that this corresponds to a time scale where you have on average 2 interaction events with each of your partners.
And so when you did the simulation and the allocation, you lost a few interactions and you had to add them somewhere else. Was there a general pattern that you always lost interactions, or did the mean of those distributions change?
Because you have context that you assign zero weight.
Yes, and yeah. As far as I understood, it doesn't always match. So you have.
This way we didn't use. We had this problem that maybe that there are some nodes that could match, that there was such a strong network segregation. So we allowed for, when we did the matchmaking between the stops, we allowed for one stop difference, for one way difference. And then we assigned, in a way, the mean weight, but we allowed only for integer weights. So sometimes we went one up and sometimes one down. We just threw a dice and set it this way, whether we go up or down.
And on average, it cancels out.
Yeah.
Okay. This more questions, please. So, I don't want to go. Push Ken's point. Just thinking kind of the paradox of HIV epidemiology has typically been that, so kind of everyone got it wrong when it was emerging, because per act probability seemed to be really high. People seem to report a lot of acts. And those two things suggested a far bigger epidemic than we've seen. And so it is, I wondered if you'd looked, I mean, the per act estimates are very uncertain, but I wondered, sort of the opposite of what Ken's saying, I wonder if you looked at the per act estimates and see if they then get you actually closer to the, because this was always the problem, that if you had any kind of normal mixing model, you didn't really know what an act was, you just knew there was a contact there, so there was some sort of fiddle compared to data that was from, you know, isolated incidents. So I wonder if you tried putting those in and see if that gets you nearer to the prevalence of HIV that was observed.
Whether they get
right,
you ask whether
I get
care estimates.
So per act estimates. So if you want to know how bad, how likely an injection is to transmit, you try to get data on a healthcare worker who's had one accidental exposure to a shark or something, and this tells you what one act does, because the problem is always that you have these repeated connections with very high per act probabilities.
Sure.
So if your fundamental parameter is one probability associated with one act.
No heterogeneity is transmission probability per interaction event. So that's fully heterogeneous. That could be considered in an extension, but it's not in here.
Okay. More questions? Thank you again.